This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 253, I Dream of Electric Cows. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a beautiful, cold, drizzly, gloomy Friday afternoon at
You
Games
keep working at- that beautiful.
At Games at Work with my friend and co-host Michael Martin. How's it going, Michael?
Hey, Michael. I'm glad to be here. I'm just imagining how much more beautiful it can get today, but I guess the answer is not much.
No, not much. Please, no more. Don't get any more beautiful.
But we've got some beautiful things to talk about.
Yes.
Starting off with a really beautiful thing to follow up on last week's show.
Yes.
Or weeks before last week's show on the Lego Cybertruck. The Tesla Cybertruck, but there's a Lego version of it that you found. Big point of conversation around the Thanksgiving table in my family, the truck, not the Lego version. What was your take on the Lego version?
I thought the Lego version was inspired. I saw this and I only remember which feed it came across. The link we have is from TechCrunch. Yep. But I saw this and it was one of those ones where you would say LOL, but you can't because you are literally laughing out loud so hard.
Yep.
It was perfect. It was ideal. It was exactly right.
It is. I hadn't scrolled all the way down, yes. but the Lego challenge to a Ford truck duel, wouldn't that be fun?
Oh, that would be hilarious.
Bouncy, 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 bouncy. That's super cool.
But yeah, it was a fun one. We had to put it in there. It's probably about a week too late, especially after all the Thanksgiving talk of people talking about the truck. But it's got to be there because it's funny. And yeah. If you haven't seen it, come to the website at gamesatwork.biz and check it out. It's hilarious.
Yes. So speaking of hilarity, this was something that just had me shaking my head and going, okay. So apparently there's some thinking around cows benefiting from virtual reality. Let me set this up and then let's discuss, because this was just like incredible. So apparently there is a Russian farm that wanted to run an experiment to see whether or not virtual reality might have an implication, a positive implication on emotional health and therefore also milk production. So the size of the VR for these cows is enormous, and
huge,
I can only imagine
huge
that they
huge VR
would have trouble, you know, just kind of maneuvering around.
I was gonna say they had to move it around their head.
so there's not a lot of data on this just yet, but oh my goodness, what do you think? Do you think this might be something that's useful?
Yeah, I heard about this from a bunch of different sources and had to track down the article. It was just hilarious. Evidently, you know, the basic premise is if you keep the cows happy and content, it would improve the quality of the milk, right? And given factory farming, yes. Where the milk cows are basically just in stalls chewing their food and cud and being milked constantly, that's not a very happy, calm, relaxing, fulfilling life. So if you could give them the stimula of being out in the pastures, the idea would be that would be better for them, and therefore it would be better for the milk. Now, I remember, I can't remember if I've talked about this on this show before, but growing up in Germany and spending a lot of time in Bavaria, I remember in the afternoons in the summer when the cows would come walking down the mountains on their own.
Yes. Yes, that's until the cows come home.
Yes, and it was just such a cool, amazing thing because we would take, you know, walks in Bavaria up on the sides of the mountains, and you would go these beautiful trails, and there'd be cows sitting around with the giant cowbells around their neck, and they'd be eating, and literally at a certain time of the day, they would just all start walking down the sides of the mountain and like through the city streets. Traffic would just let them pass by, and they would all line up and stand in front of their various barns at various houses, and it was so bizarre. So if they're bred to do that, and then suddenly their prodigy?
Their kids,
thank you. Their calves are stuck in a warehouse. I think they would like to imagine that they're walking on this. You would need little cow conveyor belts or little treadmills. Cow treadmills with cow VR goggles.
Yeah, like that circular thing just made bigger.
Yeah, everything's bigger. This article, I kept thinking that experience that I had watching what I would call happy cows. And, you know, could they live that experience with VR?
So the big yes and for me is, okay, what precisely is going on in the VR environment? And if the VR environment for these cows to, you know, reduce herd and anxiety and to give a more peaceful pastoral kind of setting. But they're not actually in it. You know, you could see these poor cows bumping around into things that maybe they shouldn't be bumping around in, or thinking that they're going to graze on in some delicious, you know, pasture land.
Yep.
And there's nothing there.
A lot of daisies.
Gotta freak them out, right?
Yep.
So I'm reminded now. I need to take a look at the advertising campaign from California, wasn't it, with the happy cows? You know, and they're happy cow. Or is it Wisconsin? Or is it
had to be Wisconsin. It wouldn't be California. It'd be raisins if it was California.
No. There was something about, you know, happy cows produce better milk or something like that, which I don't doubt for the least. I'm actually reading a book right now from a company. And I remember the company name is called Zingerman's, and it's about bacon. And it's about the history of bacon and how bacon is used in the United States and how it's such a key food stuff for the United States. In fact, the author of this particular book is comparing it to olive oil as sort of the ubiquitous thing and how it is everywhere. And it starts with a very similar construct that the pork, the pigs, happier pigs deliver better bacon, in which I'm sure they bacon. Probably do.
I don't think they deliver it.
Well,
they're committed.
Yeah. They're committed. So speaking of committed things, we've talked quite a bit over the years around how artificial intelligence is being exercised and committed to solving and winning various games, and in doing so, actually unlocking some secrets and Easter eggs and other weird, wacky things that hadn't been discovered before. And this next article is another set of arcade games, most of which I have to say I've never seen before. And there's a reason for that, because they were designed for AI to go learn and explore. But boy, they look an awful lot like Zelda and stuff here too. I mean, well, Leaper very obviously seems like a Frogger kind of thing, and then this boss fight piece is a little Asteroids-esque, maybe.
Chaser is Pac-Man, yeah.
Yeah, but still, this is kind of interesting about how AI is being extended. So, gosh, you know, wouldn't it make sense for the AI to design the game that AI can learn from, to design better AIs, to design better games? Maybe.
And this is how the apocalypse begins. It's kind of really interesting to me. I spent a lot of the summer doing research and training and learning around AI, machine learning, et cetera, to kind of figure out some of the more detailed concepts and how they apply in a business setting. Because I keep hearing people saying, oh, well, just throw AI at it, right?
That's the easy answer.
Yeah, I sat on a patent board for a while, and people would come in and go, you know, I've got this great idea, and it's going to do this, 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 and then we put it through AI, and then it does this. And you go, okay, so and what does the novel? AI do? Well, it does AI. Yeah, and that will what? getting a better grounding and learning and understanding of what real AI is and how models work and how the training needs to happen, et cetera, has been very enlightening. So when I see research like this or articles like this, I really start trying to figure out, you know, what the actual algorithms are that they're trying to learn from and how they build it. And so I'm actually really impressed by AIs that learn and teach themselves games. And then I look at these different types of things that they're trying to learn with these 16 different games and start thinking about, you know, the business application for them. So there's one where it's just a simple navigation of a maze. Well, the obvious interpretation of that is robotics moving in an environment, right? The miner, which is Dig Dug, right? That one, trying to think of what could be the business world version of it, right? And you think of data mining, but that's not what they're talking about here. So what is the application of learning that can be gleaned from other than just playing a Dig Dug type game, right?
Right.
But the thing that caught my eye with the article, obviously, was the graphics, right? You know, kind of this bizarre set of graphics of showing what's going on. So what have your thoughts been lately around some of these types of games that teach themselves about, or AIs that teach themselves about games? Anything that sticks in your mind when you see this?
Well, I've always been really curious about this sort of thing because it lines up with the education I've been doing around machine learning and AI in general too. So I like it. What I really like is the discovery of rules that are not intuitively obvious, right? So when you or I play a game, you know, normally we're able to figure out pretty quickly what is the objective of the game and how might I begin to optimize and have the play around it. The AI is not constrained by those preconceived notions and is able sometimes to figure out a novel approach to win or optimize against the goals of the game by discovery. And to me, that is really the super intriguing piece of the puzzle. And the fact that these were a bunch of games that were designed to allow an AI to start to figure those things out, I think is kind of cool. Now, the maze thing, actually, this is a funny story, too. I was listening to Science Friday earlier today, and they had a show that was focusing on slime molds. And one of the things that they said about the slime molds, and I'm forgetting now exactly what life form genus they fit it within, but it's not like a fungus or thing like that, but it's something different. These slime molds are intelligent, they're one-celled organisms, and they are capable of movement, and they are sophisticated enough that they're able to solve mazes, which when I heard this is like, what? Really? but apparently so. So that's what it reminds me of, Michael. Slime molds and
slime molds
figuring
stuff out. Slimed me.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, let's move along to an article that friend of the show, Ian, has given us to take a look at around what's gone on with Stadia and the Google launch for the new arcade space. I thought I saw a tweet or two from you on that, but I don't remember if I really did. Did you?
Yeah, I follow his blog in my feeds, and actually when I saw it, I tweeted out to him the link to his blog, and you know, kind of I figured that Ian would be one of the early adopters for Stadia, yep. And I really wanted to get his perspective. I thought his write-up was spot on. Mm-hmm. I have not played with Stadia, but it was kind of what I expected, right? The basic idea behind Stadia is very similar to what all the online virtual machine game companies have been trying to do for the last decade plus.
Yep.
Right? And so there are things that need to be considered when designing a system like this. And it's – they're getting better, but it's not quite there, right? You and I are not – what I call Twitch gamers, right? Where you're doing first-person shooters where even a millisecond difference makes a difference in the game, right? In latency. And Stadia is trying to get to the point where they claim that it'll be good enough for them. And serious gamers of that type are never going to be satisfied with any additional latency driven by the platform, right? So I don't see how that works. The other thing that, and I've been following Stadia for some time in various other articles that I worry about, is the basic Stadia license or subscription provides you with the ability to buy games. So you really don't get a lot with it. And so it's going to be pretty expensive. And then when you tie in the glitches of using a controller that has to now add additional latency between the controller and like your Chromecast, mm-hmm. and then the cloud and then the server on the cloud, it just seems like we're going to have a continuing problem here. And who knows? Maybe they'll fix it, but I don't think so. I really don't. I don't see it working ultimately to the point where a serious hardcore gamer would choose this over their own custom rig.
Yeah, it is interesting, and you've had the experience too of really interacting with the Apple competing product for this, and you've been really happy with that. But that is all between cloud and your device.
Yeah, no, that, right? See, the Apple one's completely different. It's Apple Arcade is literally a subscription to a set of games, mm-hmm. most of which just run locally on your device.
So you download them, they're on your device, off you
correct.
Go.
And you can play them offline, you can play them online. And there are, you know, there's some fighting games in there. There's Lego Brawls, mm-hmm. as an example, where you do Lego fights. And I don't mean throwing Legos at each other. Lego fight! It's a totally different design point of the game itself and the platform. They claim there will be 100 games in Apple Arcade. I've downloaded every game that comes out for Apple Arcade. I've at least launched every one. I don't know if I'm at 100 or not. But it's a very, very different model because the games are included. Stadia, it's all cloud-based, so you can't play things offline. The games are supposed to be, you know, grade-A games, you know, premier games that are traditionally platform games, right? Like PS4 games or Xbox One games or you know, gaming rig PC games. And then you get the access to them with Stadia, and then you buy the games on top of it. So there's an expense difference. There's a architectural model difference. There's a whole gameplay difference. So I don't think they compete with each other at all.
And so far, you've not used a handheld controller linked in too with your phone for the Apple Arcade games, have
No,
you?
I don't like controllers. Okay. I'm a mouse keyboard guy when it comes to PC games. Uh-huh. I wish there was better mouse keyboard support on the iPad for some of the games. The way Apple Arcade works, the same games are on tvOS, macOS, iOS.
Yep.
And so I do play some of them on my Mac with mouse and keyboard. That works okay. But again, they're not Twitchers. They're not first-person shooters that I'm playing. So it's more puzzle games, RPGs, strategy games. There's one that I picked up the other day while I was standing in line at the coffee shop, which was, it's like, oh, what's it called? Like Dear Reader or something like that? Where it's a, you're reading the classics of literature and trying to figure out puzzles on word choices for missing dialogue on the page or sentence structure sequence and things of that nature. It'd be a really, really cool game if I were 12. And I wanted to learn the classics, right? It was a way of doing that. But for me, it's kind of interesting because many of these I haven't read. And it's like, oh, I could kind of play this game and get caught up on some of those classics you were supposed to read in junior high.
Love it.
I know you used to do a PS2 games or Xbox games. Do you do any of those anymore? Do you have time?
No. We still have an earlier model PlayStation. And haven't touched it for game purposes in a long time. It's essentially a DVD player at the moment. So and we've got a Wii too, but again, haven't touched that in a long time.
Yeah, the Wii's been disconnected and put in a box.
Yeah. Well, at least it's secure there.
Oh yes, very secure.
In a box, not connected to the internet. So
Wii
speaking
in
of
a
security,
box. Oh wait a minute, that doesn't sound right.
Speaking of security, you found an article around RSA 240. So for our uninitiated, translate.
So RSA is an encryption standard, and it has different levels of encryption based off of key length, in bits. And the reason this article struck me and was so interesting is the RSA 240 was just factored. What that means is they've been able to show how you could crack it, right? And RSA 256, only 16 away, is kind of still a level of the industry standard for secure devices and secure encryption. Back in the mid to late 90s, I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, I was one of those people that was helping prove that DES 40 was not secure. Again, another encryption standard. And they were using distributed compute to break the DES encryption and show that it was no longer secure. Because at that time, you could not release a product at the global scale under U.S. law that had any encryption in it, right? And we're like, DES 40 is breakable anyway, right? So that's really not a problem. It's not like foreign actors are going to use DES 40 encryption and will not be able to be spied upon. Well, we're now at the point of RSA 240 being factored. And what this is, it's a contest that the contest is no longer an active contest. They just had a set of instructions of, you know, once you solve this one, 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 blah, 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 blah. And right. The money aspect ended some years ago. But people are continuing to try to break more and more of these encryption keys. And 240, you have to show that you can decode what the value of that encrypted key was. And they've done it, which is cool.
Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. And just, you know, knowing what's coming from a quantum perspective, there's lots of discussion about, you know, how secure going to be as quantum computing becomes more available too. As
yeah,
a, you
but
know,
the,
another
it's interesting.
On
the whole quantum aspect, basic encryption, may have problems depending on if people can figure out how to code quantum computers in such a way to solve these things.
Right.
However, the security community has been for 5 years now working on how do you define key encryption that is still secure under quantum computing.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's
right.
It's happening in parallel. And yes, old stuff might crack. And this is why when organizations hoover up all the data and mm-hmm. store it, you have to assume that your data is going to be cracked.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why there's the idea of what do they call it? Perfect forward security or perfect forward encryption, which says even if you break the key to this piece of data, it does not unlock the next piece of data with that same key. So you chunk up your data in such a way that the security keys don't open the entire suitcase. They might open one little zipper, to keep my analogy going, that provides a container that holds your dirty underwear.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's important to look at how do you encrypt things. So you need to encrypt your data at rest and in motion, so in transit. And just because you've encrypted the drive doesn't mean you shouldn't also encrypt data on the drive, right?
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
Turtles all the way down.
Turtles, and you don't want to be in a bad spot. Now, speaking of bad spots, the next article is exactly that. So it's one I stumbled upon literally earlier today from the MIT Technology Review. And apparently, I didn't read the study, but there's a new study in JAMA talking about emergency room visits and how they've been going up.
I love sentence two of the article.
Sentence two. Yes. Well, that's what happens. and this it feels a little bit like a colossal case of duh. But what's happening here is that people are using their mobile devices, not just to make phone calls where they hold them up to their ear, but they are looking at something and they fall in the proverbial manhole or trip on the edge of the curb or potentially get hit by a car because they're distracted. The other people are distracted. And the funny thing about all of this here is your phone should not be in your hand when you're caught crossing a street, you know? So it's a pretty simple thing to follow and it's a pretty simple thing to remember. So if you're walking around with your map telling you where to go, don't look at it while you're crossing the road, put it back in your pocket, cross the road, then check again if you need to. So that's your PSA for the day on using your phone as you're walking around.
Yeah, I glanced at this article, and obviously I have not read the JMA article or paper yet either. But it just becomes a common sense discussion, right? Which is sometimes neither common nor sometimes sensical for some people. But you look at this and you think about focus and attention, period. I get to feel like the old grumpy old man today.
I was sensing a get off my lawn speech.
I'm getting there. Get off my lawn. So I was driving down a major road corridor in the area here, and it's one that tends to have pretty busy traffic, and it was close to rush hour, so it was starting to really gunk up. And, you know, you can jump in the right lane and drive around everybody and cut back if you want to, right?
Right.
In this one point. And I hate people to do that, and I try not to be that person. And so I get up to the light. I see that's the case. And I'm like, nope, I'm not going to do it. And then I look up and the light's green and a car, two cars in front of me just will not move. And I'm like, I hope everything's okay. They don't, you know, the car hasn't stalled out or whatever. And finally, they start moving and get caught by the red light. So one cycle of the light. So as that was happening, the car between us cut around on the right and ran through the red light.
Oh, like, no.
Idiot. And so then I look up and I notice the person's got their phone in their hand. I'm like, ah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So then the turning lane to my left pulls up, car pulls up there. The light changes. I look over. The person at the front of the line now is sitting there with their phone in their hand. And then finally, as the left turning light turns yellow and cars are honking, they look up and they pull through. Everybody else gets caught by the red. The light changes. The car in front of me sits there. And I have to lay in the horn. It's just like, come on. You've done, you're going to go two cycles on the light because you can't get your nose out of your phone?
A little bit of crazy.
Grumpy old man. Get off my phone.
Get off your phone.
Yes. It's just like, it's just about paying attention. And I know the article talks about, well, it started spiking about the same time apps started becoming available on smartphones, blah, 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 blah. Well, I've had a smartphone since 2005, 2004 with my Trio, mm-hmm. right? It had apps, but didn't stick my nose in it while I was walking around downtown.
Or driving.
So yeah, not it's, you're actually right. This article is one of these duh articles,
yep.
but
it's a handy thing to know and it's a handy thing to remind people because often and all too often people have the phone in the hand and they're not watching where they're going.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's interesting ecosystem things that are trying to fix this. So as an example, if you're using maps in the iOS ecosystem and you have an Apple Watch, right? It will tap you or it'll make turn signal sounds.
Yeah.
And give you auditory or other haptic feedback to let you know that something needs to happen. So you don't need to stick your face in it the whole time, right? Matter of fact, you are able to turn on a setting that says hands-free, eyes-free mode. I can't remember what it's actually called, but it'll tell you things and you don't have to look at it.
Right.
As an example.
Well, and there's been the other ideas too about making your background transparent so that if you're looking down at your phone, you can see through it with the camera
and see your
what's
feet
below you, right? So you don't fall into the manhole.
Yeah.
Right. As an example. So yeah, there's some certainly some things there, and my feeling is augmented reality is going to help quite a bit with where this is going because it's going to allow people to have some level of transparency around their senses. But even with that, you're still even if you had a head up display, you got to keep your head up and pay attention to what's going around you, and the temptation of paying attention to the wrong thing is going to be a big problem.
Yep.
So Michael, to bookend maybe the start of this episode with the Lego car, there's a car from your and my youth that caught my attention today. And apparently it's one that Elon Musk decided he had to have as well. And this is the Lotus Esprit MK1 Mark I from his 1977 Spy Who Loved Me, the one that transformed into a sub and went around underneath the water. So, you know, there you wouldn't have to worry so much about people at a red light because
yeah, just well, if you ran off the end of the pier, right, you're okay.
Yeah, if you go off the edge of the pier, you know, but then you're fine, right? There's a fun story about the car in general, but I think the thing that made me giggle the most here in the end was the linkage to the truck. So this particular car apparently inspired the design team at Tesla for the truck, the Cybertruck. And Elon himself was thinking about now that he owns this vehicle, one of the ones used for the movie, thinking about putting in a Tesla drivetrain and making it transform for real. So I thought that was kind of fun.
That would rock.
Oh, and on top of all of it, the Drive Tribe site where this article is flashed up something on my screen that says, "We use cookies. If you're struggling to sleep at night, read our cookies policy." And they have a sharing. You can heart it. You can ask a question about it, or you can even share that phrase too. So good on you, Drive Tribe people, to signal what you need to signal for GDPR. Oh, Michael, been fun. I'm glad we were able to come back rested, happy from Thanksgiving with some good truck stories and some good stories about bovine creatures with VR lenses. Fun stuff.
Move.
Yeah. Oh, that's what you could have told those people in the car in front of you.
Move.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Send us links, stuff to chat about. We'll be happy to bring them up here on our next edition of Games at Work. .biz. See ya. Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.